everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm talking with Crawford Gribben about his biography of the 17th century Protestant theologian John Owen, entitled John Owen and English Puritanism, Experiences of Defeat. Crawford, welcome to the show.
Hi, Mark. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great having you on the show. I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Sure. I teach history at Queen's University, Belfast. I mainly teach 17th century history, though I do a little bit of work in modern American religion as well. Before that, I worked in University of Manchester and Trinity College Dublin, and I've always been employed really to teach early modern studies.
What led you to do a biography of John Owen?
John Owen, I think, is one of the most interesting figures from the 17th century. He's certainly one of the most prolific authors of that period. He wrote about 8 million words, which were published in around 80 different publications. Mainly he's remembered nowadays as a theologian or as someone who wrote in defence of religious toleration after 1660 in the later part of his life. But in his own day, he was also remembered for his poetry and for his preaching and for his pastoral and administrative work as well. During the middle of the 17th century, these islands went through what many historians have called a revolution, led by Oliver Cromwell after a series of civil wars. The New Republic, which was created in May of 1649, created many opportunities for individuals of often humble background who had real talents and who could use those talents to address the new opportunities that were being created. And Owen took advantage of that situation to rise from some degree of obscurity to becoming one of the most important religious administrative figures of the period. He was Vice Chancellor of Oxford University. That's the most senior academic position within that university. During the 1650s, he was also involved in protracted discussions about how to settle the question of religion in the New Republic. So given that there was a new state, what kind of religious establishment should it support? And Owen was absolutely at the centre of those discussions. Later in life, when the revolution failed and when the monarchy was returned to England, Owen found himself in a very different kind of position as the leader of a tiny church of around 30 people, but someone who continued to write vociferously and someone who created a very rich body of writing, which has remained in print until the present day, and which now I think attracts more readers than it ever did before. So Owen is an extraordinary figure. And I think one of the challenges in this book was to try to reduce someone of that significance, someone who'd written that much, into a manageable amount. The book, I think, that you mentioned is about 170,000 words long. That's much longer than anything I'd done before, but it felt short, actually, in terms of its ability to capture this extraordinary subject of John Owen.
He had this remarkable arc that you've just described, and yet you describe you subtitled the book Experiences of Defeat. I was wondering if before we get into more detail about Owen's life, you could explain exactly what you meant by that subtitle and how that informs our understanding of John Owen.
I suppose, Mark, that subtitle is maybe a wee bit provocative, in that people who've written about John Owen before, people who've written biography of John Owen, have often tended to adopt a slightly hagiographical view of the subject. So they look at him very much through rose-tinted glasses. They're often individuals or authors who are very sympathetic to Owen's theological or religious position, less often his political position, but that's another question. And they tend to represent Owen in almost a romantic haze, as if somehow the age of the English Revolution, the age of the Puritan Revolution, as it used to be called, could be represented through some kind of rose-tinted romantic hue. In fact, I argue in this book, Owen's experience in life was one of perpetual disappointment, I think, defeat. He was born into a religious culture, the culture of English Puritanism, which had already contracted after its early advances in the 16th century. Of course, he lived through a civil war, which was devastating for all concerned. He buried each of his children and his first wife. Then he committed himself to the success of a revolution which failed. He committed himself to the prosperity and health of Puritan churches or congregations, and later in life he looked at them almost in despair as he realized that they had moved very far from the kinds of positions that he had spent 8 million words defending. So when Owen dies in 1683, he dies really feeling that the entire English Reformation is about to fail, because Charles II is about to give way to his brother, the Duke of York, who was an out-and-out Catholic, and it looked as if the royal family, which was the very heart and soul of the English Protestant imagination, it looked as if the royal family was itself going to revert to Catholicism, and with that, Owen feared the Reformation would be over. So, yes, I suppose the subtitle is a bit provocative, but it does, I think, point to an enduring sense in Owen's life that he was continually struggling for successes that continually eluded him. And I think the most important cause for which he dedicated so much of his life was the cause of these Puritan churches. And I think as they failed in the 1670s and early 1680s, and as the political situation changed so dramatically to make possible the accession of a Catholic king, I think Owen certainly ended his life with very, very real concerns for the future of English Protestantism.
In a way, those concerns had been there from the beginning. And if you took a look, I was thinking, as if you took a look at the beginning of his life and at the end of his life, the concerns in some senses were the same. And yet to do it that way misses this remarkable experience of 17th century England that Owen lives firsthand. I wonder if you could take us back to his background, his childhood, and explain a bit who he was and how he came to embark upon this career as a theologian and as a minister.
Sure. Well, Owen was born in 1616. We don't know exactly when, but 1616 is 99 years after Luther posted his 95 theses to the door of the Castle Church in Wittenberg, an event which, as your interview with Peter Marshall a couple of weeks ago indicated, is often thought to indicate the beginning of the Protestant Reformation. So Owen was born 99 years after that event. And those 99 years have been quite dramatic in terms of English religion and religious politics, partly because the English Reformation had been advanced in a very ambiguous basis. So under the Tudors, the Church of England changed its doctrine, but not its style. So it still looked very much like the traditional parish worship that parishioners would have recognised from before the Reformation, even as the ideas which were being preached often changed quite dramatically. Now, this was thought to be a middle way. Queen Elizabeth promoted this as a middle way between two extremes. But for many of what historians call the hotter sort of English Protestants, this was deeply unsatisfactory. And they wanted to see the Church of England changed so that its style, its liturgy, the use of a prayer book, the use of certain kinds of clothing for priests, and even the identification of clergy as priests, they wanted all of these things to change and to become much closer to the model they saw being adopted by John Calvin in Geneva. And so this group of hot Protestants began to push and cajole for what they called further reformation of the English Church. They were nicknamed Puritans. And initially under Queen Elizabeth, they seemed to do quite well. They seemed to carry some momentum with them as they made their arguments. But whenever James VI of Scotland followed Elizabeth to the throne of England, whenever James acceded to the English throne, Puritan hopes were raised and almost immediately dashed. They were raised because James was well known to be a Presbyterian theologian. He'd published a number of theological works. He was a theologically trained monarch who'd grown up in a Presbyterian system that English Puritans recognised to be quite similar to what they wanted to achieve. So Puritan hopes were raised, but they were immediately dashed because no sooner had James made it south across the border than he realised that the episcopal system of the Church of England, the system of government by bishops within the Church of England, which was quite different to the much more democratic Presbyterian system north of the border, James realised that this system of government by bishops actually reinforced the power of the king. And so he famously declared no bishop, no king, and swept aside the many demands that the Puritans were making of him to pursue the further reformation of the English Church. So by about 1604, 1605, English Puritans really felt that they had been suddenly outmaneuvered, and that by the monarch. And so in 1605, an individual, a Church of England clergyman called William Bradshaw, published a book called English Puritanism. And Bradshaw's book, English Puritanism, was something of a manifesto. It suggested ways by which the godly, the hotter Protestants, could continue to work together to build relationships, networks, communities, to sustain fellowship as the English Puritan movement entered into eclipse. So that's very much the background to Owen's birth in 1616. He was born into a family, the father of which was a Church of England minister, so someone who probably had Bradshaw's concerns and hopes about the sustention of this Puritan subculture within the English Church. Unlike lots of other Puritans, Henry Owen, who was John Owen's father, had not emigrated. He hadn't gone to the New World. He hadn't gone into the Netherlands. He had chosen to stay within the Church of England to eke out some kind of ambiguous and probably fairly precarious parish career. So whenever Owen was born, John Owen was born in 1616, that was the kind of family he was born into, a clerical family, the family of a Church of England clergyman, but a Church of England clergyman who was doing his best to retain something of the older Puritan sensibility within the politically ambiguous cultures of the Church of England.
One of the things you make clear in the book is how difficult it is to access John Owen's life. And one of the things you do in it is you draw upon his writings to get a better understanding of it. And this is something that note is a little different than how previous biographers have approached John Owen. I was wondering if you could explain that approach a bit and how it informs our understanding of Owen's life.
Sure. Well, people who've written about Owen in the past tend to do so under two headings. First of all, there's quite a considerable body of high historical theology, which takes Owen as its subject. Now, many of the people who write this historical theology tend to adopt fairly old-fashioned views of the subject, so that they tend to take ideas somewhat outside of context. They tend to represent ideas as operating almost autonomously within the world of ideas, as if there can be a rarefied world of ideas. And so much of this historical theological writing is very, very helpful in showing how Owen relates to perhaps the bigger Reformed context, or perhaps the legacy of the pre-Reformation church and medieval scholastic theology. But it doesn't do a good job of situating Owen's ideas within the changing context of his own life. The other group of publications which takes Owen as its subject tends to adopt this biographical view. There hasn't been much written in terms of Owen biography in the last 30 years. One very exciting exception to that is Tim Cooper's book on John Owen, Richard Baxter, and the formation of nonconformity, which came out, I think, around 2009. Now, Tim Cooper, who teaches history at the University of Otago, showed in this book how a very particular focus on one decade of a very troubled relationship between Owen and Richard Baxter, these two theological giants of the English Puritan movement who took very different views of many of the issues that were being debated during this period. Tim Cooper showed that this very specific focus on a decade or a couple of decades of their life and their very tricky friendship could yield extraordinary dividends when historians read theological writing with biographical questions in view. And really, what I try to do in this book is to take Tim's method and apply it much less ambitiously just to one individual, but to do that across the course of that one individual's life. So Tim, I think, has really set up a new way of thinking about biography and how biography can work when the material of biography is lost, or where the only material available for biography is text, the genre of which may be deeply unsympathetic to biographical work. And so for this project, I set about to read Bowen's works in chronological order, thinking about context, if he was engaging in debates, trying to reconstruct those debates in my own head, and trying to look at manuscript sources, trying to get a richer, fuller sense of the material circumstances, as well as the ideological or theological circumstances in which Owen was composing his work. And that's what I tried to do. So yeah, it's new in the sense that it's developing Tim Cooper's method. It's much less geared towards historical theology than so much of the really excellent work that's been published in Owen does. But hopefully it's still got something to add to that conversation.
That approach is a bit more frustrated when you're talking about those early years, because he doesn't start writing until he's in his late 20s, early 30s. I was wondering if you could explain a bit what we do know about his education and his early theological development before you get to when he starts publishing books in the 1640s.
Yeah. Well, it seems as if Owen grew up in the home of this moderate Puritan, Henry Owen, his father. And it seems as if Henry Owen sent Owen to the University of Oxford, which was not that far away from where the family was living, less than 10 miles away or thereabouts. John Owen went in his very early teens along with his elder brother to begin studies at Queen's College in Oxford. But these teenagers found themselves, as they began their undergraduate study, in the middle of a theological war, because Queen's College in Oxford had gone through its own religious revolution. Like the university of which it was a part, it had been pushed away from the explicit Reformation emphases of the college as it had developed through the later 16th and early 17th century. And under the leadership of a new provost, a man called Christopher Potter, Queen's College had begun to move in quite a strikingly new direction. Now, this new direction was in some ways reflecting that of the Church of England as a whole, because one of the decisions taken by King James in his later years and by Charles, his son, in the early years of his reign, was to promote not the old Calvinism, not the explicitly reformed theology that had characterized so much of the 16th century English Reformation, but a new style of theology, a style of theology known as Arminianism, after its celebrated intellectual leader, a man called Jacob Arminius, a Dutch theologian. But this Arminianism wasn't just a set of ideas, although it was a set of ideas. It also involved a new way of thinking about worship and a new way of thinking about the history of the English church. So in a typical Calvinist service, for example, the emphasis would have been on the sermon and in teaching through the sermon. In an Arminian-influenced service of worship, the emphasis would have been much less on the sermon than upon sacraments. Arminians were also pushing for altars to be reintroduced into English churches. They were pushing for clergymen to be dressed in certain kinds of decorative clothing, liturgically significant clothing. And I think most importantly of all, they also wanted English churchmen to rethink their relationship to the Catholic Church. Whereas the older Calvinists had wanted to see the Reformation as very much a break with the unreformed medieval Christianity they associated with the Catholic Church, the Arminians wanted to see continuity as far as possible. Now, within Queen's College, these very rarefied debates about ideas of theology and about the practicalities of worship took on a very divisive form, because the faculty split over this issue of Calvinism versus Arminianism. And in fact, there's records from this period describing faculty members threatening to stab each other as the debate intensified. So there was a real threat of violence within the college. And it must have been a very disorientating experience for this young teenager, John Owen, as he learned through the study of the curriculum and also as he tried to find his own way, both within the university and within the Church of England. Because Owen had gone to Oxford to prepare to become a clergyman within the Church of England. By 1632, he'd taken his BA and he'd been ordained as a deacon by the Bishop of Oxford, John Bancroft, who was one of the individuals best known for promoting this new liturgical and theological style. In 1635, he took his MA, and in 1637, he decided he had to leave the university. Had he stayed, he would have had to have signed up to the liturgical and theological changes that were taking place, but he couldn't do that. And so at the age of 21, he decided his academic career was essentially over. He felt that he had been shut out of the English church, and he left and began a period of some depression. Now, it's not quite clear what was behind that depression. Certainly in 1638, Owen found his way back to the Bishop of Oxford to be ordained as a priest. And I think it's very tempting to speculate that his depression was linked both to his sense of failure, his sense of being excluded from the career that he had chosen to pursue, but also I think his sense that the only way in which he could pursue that career was by recognising the legitimacy of the authority of church leaders who were doing their utmost, he might have thought, to reverse the Protestant Reformation and to take England back to Rome. So by the time Owen gets ordained as a priest in 1638, he begins to pursue a private clerical career. In other words, he doesn't become a parish clergyman, but he takes up a chaplaincy position in the home of Sir Robert Dormer and later in the home of John Lord Lovelace. It's really interesting to think why he did that, because both Robert Dormer and John Lord Lovelace indicated that their lives were certainly not the lives of eminent Puritans. And when civil war broke out in August 1642, both those individuals chose to side with the king rather than with Parliament. Owen, by contrast, had decided to move with Parliament. And so he gets shut out of employment in 1642 as well, moves to London, gets some lodgings in Charterhouse, which is one of the most notorious parts of the city at that period of time, experiences something like conversion and begins to write. And that's really when the recoverable John Owen begins.
You describe how in his early years, entering the ministry, he had turned to people like Dormer and Lovelace, and this gets to one of these points you make in the book, which is that a lot of his career was intertwined with patronage, and how he had these patrons who played a very important role in not only supporting him, but bringing him to broader attention. And this is something that you see, especially as you describe, during the English Civil War. I was wondering if you could perhaps explain a bit what he does during the war and how he comes to assume such a position of prominence by the end of it.
Sure. At the beginning of the Civil War, Owen's really a non-entity. Living in London. But he begins to publish books, and he makes a very calculated decision to dedicate his books to people who can do him good. And he publishes his first book, A Display of Arminianism, as it was called, a long book of theological polemic, which he dedicates to a committee operating within the House of Commons that was in charge of allocating parish ministries. And it works. He comes to the attention of this committee and they appoint him to his first parish in Essex. Now, we know quite a lot about what this parish was like, as well as the next parish that Owen went to, which was a neighbouring parish, partly because his next door neighbour, in parish terms, a man called Ralph Josselyn, a Presbyterian clergyman, kept a voluminous diary of this period. And so we get a real sense of what it was like on the ground to watch Owen pursue patronage, the patronage of local landowners or the patronage of significant people in the locality who could in some way do him good. Now, by 1648, at the close, at the middle part of the Second Civil War, Owen takes his pursuit of patronage to a new degree, because there was a big siege at the town of Colchester, about 10 miles away from where Owen was based at that point. What happened was that a column of royalist troops had kidnapped a couple of local politicians, and they had taken these politicians into Colchester, which was a walled town, without really having thought about how their being in Colchester could be sustained in the longer term. The city was easily surrounded, was easily cut off from the sea, it was easily cut off in terms of supply. And so Fairfax, General Sir Thomas Fairfax, led the parliamentary army, the New Model Army, in pursuit of this column of royalist soldiers with their local political hostages into Colchester. They dug trenches around the city, and for about 10 weeks that summer, July and August of 1648, they pursued a siege of the town. Now, it was a really brutal and dangerous siege, and there's reports from the period of both the besieged and the besiegers setting animals on fire in an effort to disrupt the lines of their antagonists. Owen took advantage of this to some extent, but by going down to Colchester, by preaching to the soldiers, by befriending the hostages after Fairfax eventually released them. And then in the autumn and winter of 1648, coming to the attention not just of General Fairfax, the leader of the New Model Army, the parliamentary army, but also to one of his most significant friends, a man called Oliver Cromwell. Now, why this is significant is that several weeks, probably around early December, mid-December 1648, Owen was invited to preach to MPs in what was a fairly standard kind of religious service in the 1640s. But what no one could have reckoned at that point was that the date which the invitation had given to Owen to travel to Westminster to preach to the MPs was the day, or rather would be the day after, the execution of the King, Charles I. In other words, you could say it was England's very first day as a republic. The end of January 1649, Owen preached this commemorative sermon to MPs, describing in providential terms what had just happened and explaining to them how the execution of the king was actually part of God's plan for the nations at the end of time. And so this very robust defence of parliamentary action in executing the king saw Owen become ever more closely identified with his new patron, Oliver Cromwell, who in the months after January 1649 would come to be the most significant leader of the Republican Party as that new regime took shape in the aftermath of the Second Civil War.
You point out it wasn't just Cromwell who was impressed by his sermon, that Parliament invited him back to preach during the next fast day. So they generally responded very well to what he was saying, and he is receiving that support. Although, as you point out, you know, it really is difficult to find in 1649 a better patron in England, in all of England, than Oliver Cromwell.
That's right. Cromwell opens up a huge number of opportunities for Owen, and it becomes the most significant and also one of the most problematic of Owen's relationships in the 1650s. So, one of the most important invitations that Cromwell gives to Owen is to invite Owen, or actually compel Owen, to attend the invasion of Ireland in 1649. So Cromwell led a column of, I think, around 18,000 troops, which landed in Dublin in August 1649, which divided into two and which swept up and down the east coast of Ireland and then into the centre of the island in an effort to subjugate the royalist defence that remained on that island. And in fact, in 9 months, the Cromwellian army achieved what no English army had ever before achieved in Ireland, which was to completely subdue the island to English political achievements. 1 year later, Owen also accompanied the army in its invasion of Scotland. That was a quite different experience of invasion. And I think also he was horrified by some of the things that he had witnessed during the invasion of Ireland. And he spoke quite movingly, actually, about the horrors that he had seen on the streets of Dublin. Now, of course, by 1651, two of his brothers had also seen military action in Ireland, and one of them had died there. So Owen himself had begun to be touched by the reality of revolution before perhaps it had been something he could preach about. By about 1650-51, it was something he'd begun to experience personally. And as he experienced it personally, he retreated somewhat from the high theological defence of the English Republican agenda, and I think began to nuance his view of Cromwell and of the Cromwellian regime, partly because the Cromwellian regime was growing more socially conservative, but also, someone like Owen might have thought, it was moving further away from the godly ideals that many of the Puritans had referred to in their early defences of this new regime.
This nuanced approach that you described, though, didn't inhibit his rise, because it was after his return that he is appointed the Dean of Christ Church and assumes a role in the administration of the University of Oxford.
That's right. So it's only about, 13, 14 years after Owen had left Oxford in despair of any future academic career there, that he's invited to come back, first of all, as Dean of a college, Christ Church, and then in 1652 to become Vice Chancellor of the entire university, the most senior academic position that there is there. But I think Owen seems to have struggled at Oxford. I think partly because nothing had prepared him to take up such a senior administrative position. When he had preached to soldiers en route to war in Ireland, or when he had preached to soldiers who were actually on the field during the Scottish invasion, he was able to present issues in very morally binary ways. Things were very black and white for him. But, you know, faculty politics are never black and white. They're very ambiguous. But threatening in a different kind of way. And Owen seems really to have struggled with the emergence of academic parties within Oxford, and used sometimes high-handed methods to get around them, and sometimes very devious ways to get around them. One of the things that Owen did whenever he wanted to push through a particular resolution was to make sure that the committee considering that resolution met on the 25th of December, knowing that the Conservatives who sat in that committee would far rather be home eating their turkey dinner and celebrating Christmas than sitting at a table with his grim and glowering Puritan disposition. So, you know, he was up to all kinds of tricks at Oxford, trying to get certain kinds of reforms pushed through. He was largely successful. Oxford seems to have been a relatively harmonious place during his tenure as Vice Chancellor. Certainly, he worked hard during that period actually to protect people who had different politics from his own, or who had a slightly different theology from his own, on the basis that they were excellent scholars. And so I think historians argue that he did have the health of the university at the forefront of his mind, that his reformation of Oxford was very much geared towards academic standards rather than some kind of ideological or religious purity. I think that's a very significant nuance in his own understanding of his role within that place, that there were times when he was prepared not to push individuals out of the way because they happened to have a much warmer view of the old Church of England than he had done.
This really represented in many respects the peak of his life, not just in terms of his position as Vice Chancellor, but also that his patron, Oliver Cromwell, becomes Lord Protector of England, in effect the ruler of England. And yet, because his fortunes and his success are so closely tied to the revolution and Oliver Cromwell, once Oliver Cromwell dies in 1658, that is going to portend a change. How does Owen's life change with Cromwell's passing and then the restoration that follows?
Well, I said earlier on, Mark, that Owen's relationship to Cromwell becomes difficult in the 1650s. And it's tricky to work out exactly when that difficulty is introduced. I think that that's partly because Owen's own position changes. Owen is a writer in his 8 million words who can tell you different things or give different explanations, sometimes conflicting explanations for the same events. So I'll give you an example of that. In the first Protectoral Parliament in 1654, the first Parliament, which was convened after Oliver Cromwell became the Lord Protector of England, Owen was elected as an MP. And he only sat as an MP for about 3 or 4 months. He was eventually ejected on the basis that his being in orders, his having been ordained, actually made him ineligible to stand as a Member of Parliament. But during those 3 or 4 months when Owen sat as an MP in the first Protectoral Parliament, there's hints in the documentary record that he was socialising with or spending time with individuals who were very, very hostile to this new turn in the administration. The years from 1649 to 53 were seen by many individuals as the golden years of the Republic. The move to the recognition of a single leader as a figurehead for the nation, as the Lord Protector was, that move, which happened in 1654, was seen by these individuals as somehow a backsliding away from the attainments of the earlier years of the Republic. And Owen, as an MP, identifies with critics of the Protectorate. Now, he still depends upon Owen still depends upon Cromwell to be sustained as Vice-Chancellor of Oxford, for example. And that relationship continues until about 1656-57, when Owen begins to give these coded criticisms of some of the happenings within the Lord Protector's household. The Lord Protector's household had begun to sponsor dances, operatic entertainment. It was looking more and more like a royal family in the making. And in fact, in 1657, there was an attempt by many MPs representing a very socially conservative constituency to have the Cromwell family become the new royal family of England. And Cromwell himself seems to have recognised that, in fact, this might be one way of solidifying and stabilising the new regime. But this was a horror to the old Republicans who were closely identified with Owen. And so many military officers, number of military officers associated with General Charles Fleetwood, who was Cromwell's brother-in-law, worked together with Owen to create a petition. Owen actually wrote the petition for them. The petition argued that Cromwell should not accept the throne, should not become King Oliver I. And the military officers presented this to Cromwell and argued with him to make sure that he didn't, in fact, accept the throne. And this seems to have been a turning point in Cromwell's view of Owen. If Owen was already suspicious of Cromwell, by 1657, Cromwell had become very suspicious of Owen. And in fact, the relationship cools noticeably from that period. And Owen doesn't see Cromwell in the months before Cromwell's death in early September 1658. When Oliver Cromwell dies on the 3rd of September 1658, he gets followed by his son, Richard, who becomes the new Lord Protector. But Richard has none of his father's diplomatic skill or links to the military, and so simply isn't trusted or isn't thought to be able for the position into which he's been intruded. And so Cromwell, Fleetwood, and that familiar group of Republican officers work together to create a political crisis which brings down Richard's Lord Protectorship. The Republicans hope to see Richard replaced with a much more Republican-friendly Parliament. In fact, that doesn't happen. And the only achievement of their coup is to knock down the first of a chain of dominoes, which eventually ends up 2 years later with the return of Charles II to the throne of England. So in some ways, Owen is there at the very, very beginning of the Republic. He preaches the day after the execution of Charles I. Owen is also there at the very end of the Republic. He is the individual, perhaps, who takes the most significant role in creating the conditions through which Richard falls. And I suppose the great paradox of this period of Owen's life is that he creates the conditions for the restoration. He actually facilitates, without realizing it, the return of the king.
A lot of the people who were involved with the regime, and particularly the execution of Charles, were executed themselves or driven into exile. How is it that Owen is able to survive?
Yeah, they were treated. They were tracked down. The regicides were tracked down. Some were kidnapped. Some were arrested. Some were murdered in England or abroad. When Charles II returned to the throne, he had, in effect, a death list, a hit list, of the names of individuals who had signed his father's death warrant. A few months after his coming back to the throne, an election was held for a new parliament. And the Cavalier Parliament, which convened in 1661, represented a community with much greater hostility to the Republicans than even perhaps Charles II. And so the hit list grew, and it grew and grew. It's not quite clear why Owen was not among the victims. Other men like Hugh Peter, who was not a regicide, who had not signed the death warrant, but who had preached in defence of the king's death, was among those who were hunted down and hung, drawn, and eventually cut into quarters, beheaded, with body parts on display for 25 years after the event. So it's not quite clear why, if Hugh Peter was tracked down and destroyed in that way, why Owen was not. It's possible that patronage came into view again, because we know in this period that Owen was living in the houses of various and sometimes surprising highly placed individuals, including, for example, the Earl of Oxford, who had spent time in the Tower of London in the 1650s because of his subversive royalist politics. But now Owen was looking to people like the Earl of Oxford for protection, and was getting protection from some of these individuals. It's also possible that the Earl of Clarendon was commissioning Owen to write on his behalf. There's a couple of books published anonymously, but we know by Owen, in the early 1660s, in which he writes very fulsomely of Charles II. And it's possible that what's behind this is manipulation on the part of the Earl of Clarendon. We know that Clarendon was going around and exploiting even some of his old friends in this period, giving them protection on the basis of favours, sometimes financial favours, sometimes perhaps, as in Owen's case, ideological or artistic favours. But Owen, however he did it, was surviving. I think he really struggled to know how to relate to the Restoration. He seems to have attempted to buy land in New England. He had certainly been invited to Boston by a church there. He'd been invited to an academic position at Harvard, and he took those invitations seriously enough to attempt to buy some land in Massachusetts. That came to nothing. He was also amassing weapons in his own house. In fact, in 1661, his house was raided, and several sets of pistols, I think six or seven pairs of pistols, were confiscated. This was during a time in which ex-Republicans, or old Republicans, I should say, were being suspected of attempts at insurrection, actually suspected with good reason, because there were several attempts to reverse the Restoration during this period. So Owen was both attempting to escape the Restoration, attempting to resist the Reformation. He was also, in some senses, defending it, speaking very highly of Charles II, describing him in a couple of books as the greatest Protestant and the greatest potentate in the whole of Europe, which is an extraordinary claim if you know anything about the king's private life or religious preferences. And I think Owen, you know, just didn't know how to respond, and so responds, perhaps seeing his friends horrible deaths, responds in a confused and chaotic way, doing his utmost, whatever he does, doing his utmost to survive, to protect himself, to protect his family, and I suppose hopefully to protect the churches of which he was a part.
That adds a certain melancholy to that last two plus decades of his life, where he has fallen from favor. He's no longer the vice chancellor of Oxford. He is fortunate, as you were describing, to have escaped with his life. And And so he's witness to all of the events that happened that follow that seem to unravel it. And you describe not, and the, add to that the personal tragedies with you know, the loss of his children, the loss of his wife. How does he process that in his writings? Because you describe that he's still producing considerable you know, works of theology and considerable commentary that's some of the most significant works of his career.
Yeah, it's a good question, Mark. How did he process it all? Owen seems to have been a deeply private individual. He doesn't write confessionally. He doesn't write self-reflection. He doesn't write letters, as far as we know, that describe in detail his emotional response to these things. He hasn't left behind him any personal papers which would describe the way in which he responded to these things, at least not as far as we know. Perhaps the only glimpse we can get into Owen's response to these events is to compare two portraits, a portrait of him recently rediscovered in Dr. Williams' library. This actually is the portrait in the front of the book, on the hardback cover of the book, a portrait of Owen in the middle 1650s in his Oxford regalia, looking very well fed, very well watered. He's a man of substance and girth, obviously a man of power, the way in which he's dressed with academic robes, certain kinds of gloves, his hand is in the book. You know, he looks successful, he looks self-satisfied. There's another portrait taken of Owen in 1667. So this is about 10 years later and on the other side of the Restoration. And it's the most famous portrait of Owen. It's essentially black and white. He's dressed in black, he's got a white shirt on, he's got a black skull cap on. His face is very pale. His face is very thin. He looks haunted. Of course, you don't want to psychologize someone's representation of their subject in a painting, but it's very striking to see the difference in physiognomy between these two portraits. Owen looks drawn, perhaps even scared in his response.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Sure. It's totally different, Mark. It's not 17th century at all. It's a project about a modern religious community which is gathering in North Idaho, which may be up to 10,000 people strong, which is very interested in the kind of theology that Owen is describing and defending in his books, but which is also interested in ideas of resistance to American modernity. So this is a book called Survival and Resistance in American in Evangelical America, and I'm co-writing it with my friend at University of Glasgow called Scott Spurlock. Hopefully that'll come out within the next year or two.
That sounds like a fascinating book. I look forward to reading it.
I'll talk to you then.
Crawford, thank you very much for taking some time to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thanks, Mark. Great to talk to you too.